Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Amy Sherald, born Columbus, Georgia in 1973, received her BFA from Clark Atlanta University in 1997 and her MFA from Maryland Institute College of Art in 2004. Sherald paints dynamic portraits designed to divulge an erudite understanding of the psychological consequences of stereotyping and racism. Each portrait depicts a friend or acquaintance suspended in vivid fashions before a nondescript background. Skin tones are represented using a grayscale as a way of challenging the concept of color as race. Sherald is critical of African American cultural history and the representation of black bodies, and her portraits are satirical manifestations of identities shaped by political, social, economic, and cultural influences. In 2016, Sherald was the first woman to win the Outwin Boochiever Portrait Competition Grand Prize from the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery. In this conversation, held on October 29, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, Sherald discusses her career, artistic process, and latest projects with Aaron Cristoval. This program is coordinated with Now Be Here No. 4, DMV, the fourth and final U.S. iteration of a project to gather female and female-identifying visual artists for a group photograph of historic proportions.
Go, Amy. Go, Amy. Go,
it's my birthday.
Go,
it's
my Amy.
Birthday.
Go,
it's
Amy. Go, Amy.
I don't think my mic, is my mic on? Okay, it's on.
Yeah, it's on.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, how's everyone feeling today? Yes, it's a lovely celebratory Sunday, I'd say.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to thank you all for being here. It's such a pleasure to be in conversation with Amy. So we sort of met through a conversation that we were having and me thinking about writing this essay for the Studio Museum show. And we were on the phone and we were just chatting and, you know, Amy was like, I really like the questions you're asking. And I was like, okay, cool. And she's like, do you want to do this little conversation with me? And I was like, sure. And just had no idea that, you know, we'd be here today in conversation. So thank you for roping me into this.
Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, of course. So as you can see, Amy's work is behind us. And I'm just going to kind of go through some questions and sort of thinking about your process, your practice, and then portraiture in general and how you sort of came to it. So one of the first questions I really love to ask artists is thinking about their family tree, so to speak. Who are the artists that really inspired you, that you know, are in conversation with your work, and who you think are just really important in considering how you relate to art, contemporary art in general?
Well, I had a little bit of an untraditional upbringing. So my parents never really took me to museums, and art wasn't in the scope of things that I was supposed to think about doing with my life. So I grew up looking at encyclopedias. I was looking at the old masters that were in encyclopedias. And so that was my introduction into art and the reason why I think I gravitated towards the figure, because to me, being an artist at that point, you know, 7, 8 years old, was being able to render the figure. And so I think I went to the museum for the first time when I was in college, and it was for an assignment. No, the first time was a field trip in the sixth grade, but that was the first time that I saw a painting of a person that looked like me in a space like that. So it was the first time I had gone to the museum. I'd been looking at portraiture in encyclopedias in different places, but to come into a museum and see a contemporary painting done by Beau Bartlett was mind-blowing for me, because as far as I knew up until that moment, like, there were no paintings of black people. So that changed what I thought I could do with my life in that moment, honestly. It's like, I mean, I feel like he should pay me because I talk about him all the time. I'm like, Beau Bartlett, Beau Bartlett, Beau Bartlett. But it was a portrait, it was a self-portrait of him as a black man. And he was standing in a yard with a woman and two little boys. And maybe it's because of where I was from. I was from the Deep South. I never assumed that it was a family, but he painted it as a family. And so that's, I really believe that what's absent in history is absent in our expectations. And so that was a revealing moment for me when I found out, like maybe 4 years ago, that it was an actual family. Mm. And what was the other?
Just thinking about like who's in your family tree. So even artists that, you know, don't necessarily make the same sort of work that you do, mm-hmm. but artists that you look up to or you appreciate their practice.
Yes. Well, my first real interaction with a living artist was Arturo Lindsay, who was my painting instructor at Spelman. And we paint very differently, but he was a scholar as well, so he really got me engaged in a critical way that I had not been engaged before. You know, it was kind of like a frivolous painter, like I want to paint feathers and I want to paint a cocoon, you know. And so he really got me thinking, along with like a lot of vicarious experiences that I had traveling with him and working for him in Panama, that it was something that I need to pursue and like get a master's degree and do. So, and I say, like, I graduated with a master's degree, but I had no idea who Kerry James Marshall was, and I had no idea who Barclay Hendricks was. And I had started to make this work, and Kerry James Marshall had an exhibition at the Baltimore Museum, and I walked in and I freaked out and I called Arturo. I'm like, so there's this guy and he makes his paintings and like we both paint like black people gray and black. And I'm like, can I still do what I'm doing? And he's like, don't worry about it, it's very different. You know. And then I came across Barclay Hendricks probably within that same 2 year span. But again, like I saw similarities in what we were doing, and I realized that they had paved the way for me to be where I was, yeah.
Absolutely, and the more the merrier. You know, I mean, I think that's something that as a curator, I'm always thinking about, which is, you know, historically thinking about a larger art canon and the way that black people, our bodies are positioned in that is always sort of complicated. And it's not until you get into the contemporary sphere where you actually start to see figures created and painted by other black artists. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, in considering the museum and what the institution means, you know, people don't always feel welcome in that space because they don't always see their likeness in that space. So I think, you know, you're in this tradition of making it be known that, you know, we belong here and we exist in this space mm-hmm. too, and we're just as much as part of the conversation. So thank you. So in sort of getting into like the formal aspects of your work, and you kind of touched on this a bit, the skin tones that you're using for the people in your work has always interested me, in that it's not this sort of deep black, you know, that Kerry James uses, or sort of a lighter brown, which Barclay uses. So I thought the gray was really interesting, and it's also a way to kind of, I think it's sort of inviting also, in that, you know, we're aware that we're looking at black people, but there's something about that skin tone that abstracts this idea, which I think is a larger part of, you know, thinking of the fantastical nature of your work. So can you sort of speak to like the moment you discovered like this is the tone that I want to work with and why?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, everything I think we do as artists is it's for aesthetic purposes at first. Mm-hmm. And so for me, all those things come after I start the work, because I don't think I can't work with a lot of words in my head. And so now looking back on it, I realized that I just thought it looked cool at first, yeah. Right? And then secondly, I think because my work in grad school was so ambiguous, you know, I had never painted a figure that somebody instantly recognized as black. And so I almost had a fear of being marginalized. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like subconsciously trying to figure out a way around that, because I knew that the black body on a canvas is politicized immediately, mm-hmm. and these weren't the kind of, that wasn't the way that I wanted the images and the people to live in the world. Mm-hmm. Like they were supposed to be almost the antithesis of that. Mm-hmm. So, and now when I look back again, because as the series progressed or the work progressed, I began to do like visual research, and I came across, you know, the old daguerreotypes and old black and white images. And so that really changed my perspective on portraiture, really, because those were the places that I found myself, like looking at these photographs of, you know, even my grandmother, but they were after the invention of the camera, when we were able to become authors of our own narrative, mm-hmm. and you know, show our connection to a history that was connected to love and not just oppression and struggle. Mm-hmm. And so that was a huge affirmation for me. I think I came across an image from Du Bois's Paris exposition, mm-hmm. and it was almost the same as my painting. I did a painting with called The Rabbit in the Hat. It's a guy with a bow tie and a bunny rabbit, mm-hmm. but it was just a black man in a bow tie, but I mean, it just was, we were speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. And so for me, photography, or my work has really become a meditation on photography. I think I find great inspiration in that and cinematography. Like Wes Anderson is my hero, I love him.
Absolutely, and just getting back to the gray skin tone, I think as you were saying that, what I was thinking is that the gray skin tone also implies the potential, which is the potential for black people to exist within a diaspora,
yeah.
which is to say that we look all sorts of ways and we have all sorts of skin
yeah.
tones. And so it's this really amazing neutral point where you can sort of branch out from there.
Yeah, it's almost, I'm just thinking while I'm talking to you, it's like almost starting from scratch, mm-hmm. because we all realized that race and blackness was the construct. Mm-hmm. And so to imagine ourselves without that kind of external directive that influences how we think about ourselves, like who would we be?
Right.
How would I be, you know? I always say like, how would falling in love be if I had never heard a love song before? Because I feel like I already knew it was gonna happen since I was six, you know? Michael Jackson told me, Luther Vandross told me. So, you know, I mean like, so there's a search for some aspect of myself that wasn't preformed by either my parents or the world,
right.
you know, in general.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And just to speak on patterns, I mean, one thing I love about your work is like these really sharp, vibrant moments of pattern or color that you just sort of plop in there and it just like brightens up the entire canvas. And so I wanted to ask you about pattern making, mm-hmm. sort of where that desire comes from for you, and how you sort of consider which patterns go on which people and how you adorn them.
Yeah, it's all intuitive. I mean, this young girl here, she had on this dress when I met her, so that was really easy. She was the perfect subject. But a lot of times it comes down to what, you know, again, like aesthetically, like what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And I usually, again, I go to the internet and I'm like, I usually, every day I'm on the internet and I might see something, I might see a pattern, I might see something that I like, and I have a folder in my Instagram account, mm-hmm. and I have a folder on my laptop that I just pull different images of clothes into. And when I need a resource, I go back to that to figure out what's gonna work. So that's generally how it works, and it's intuitive, like what needs to go here and what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you walk us through like the moment that you find someone on the street and you're like, hey, this is the person that I want to paint, and sort of what that process is, what it means to bring them into the studio, what it means to paint them, and then from there, what sort of touches you add onto the canvas that, you know, didn't necessarily exist with them, but mm-hmm. that you're sort of bringing out of them?
It's the same feeling that you get when you like first saw your husband or wife, kind of. I mean, I look at them and I'm like, ta-da, I just know it's them. And then I have to work up the courage to talk to them, because I'm usually kind of awkward when it comes to that. And everybody thinks I want to paint them naked all of a sudden, too. So I'm like, no. So I usually walk up to them and I say, you know, I'm an artist. And I say, but like a real artist. Like I have work in museums and stuff. Can I text you my website? I get their email address to make sure that I don't lose them and that I can stalk them until they say yes, if they are thinking about it. And then sometimes I'll call them right back 2 weeks later. Sometimes it could be a year. This young woman right here, I met at Artscape, and I called her 8 months later, and I really didn't know what I wanted her to wear, so I said, just go into your closet and pull out your three favorite outfits and text them to me, like send me pictures. And so she did that, and then I picked her up. Like, I had, again, like had a 2 minute conversation with her. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna come pick you up and bring you back to my studio. And she just happened to bring this doll, which was perfect, you know, and I really saw myself in her, because when I was her age, she was like 22, I had shaved my head, I had a LeBray, I was like going through my goth phase. And, you know, just really exploring, but really feeling like an outsider because I was on Spelman's campus, right? So, like, I was, like, the weird black girl. Yeah. But so once the photograph is taken, the figure will always stay the same. I think the pose stays the same, but sometimes, and now more often than not, I end up changing the clothes or the colors of what they have on. So, like, this guy right here, he had on a red navy blue and gray sweatshirt. The t-shirt was not camouflage, but the print on the shirt was there, mm-hmm. right? So it just, what he had on, the color palette just wasn't working for me, and so like I had to adjust that. And lately also the backgrounds have become flattened because for some reason, I don't know why yet, maybe I'll know next year, the speckling isn't working for me anymore either. So I think I'm transitioning into a different place with it. Like, I think it's gonna stay the same, but my backgrounds, I'm really trying to figure out how to address them in a deeper way, mm-hmm. but not placing them anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's still gonna be like something flat.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to speak on Baltimore in general, mm-hmm. Which as someone who has only been there for, you know, a day or so, I think like we have very interesting cultural references of what Baltimore as a space is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in, you know, thinking of film, of course I'm gonna jump to John Waters.
Yeah.
as a starting point and thinking of the sort of flamboyant, excessive idea of Baltimore. And then I'm gonna jump to The Wire, mm-hmm. Which is a very real sort of breakdown of how the city works and thinking of class and race and gender. And in an interesting way, I kind of see your paintings falling in between both of those ideas of the mm-hmm. spectrum. So can you kind of speak to Baltimore, what it means for you to be there? You know, I think for a lot of East Coast artists, there's this idea of like, oh, I made it, I'm moving to New York, you know?
Yeah.
But what it means to really hold it down yeah. in that city and how that city shows up in your work.
Well, for me, moving to New York didn't seem like a logical decision because I felt like I would have to hustle too hard. And so Baltimore is still a really easy city to live in because it's developed with the intention of having artists in the city. And so, I mean, I have a 900 square foot studio space now that's only $900. And so, So I was able to, so I supported myself by waiting tables. I was a waitress till I was 38. And by the time I quit, I was making a lot of money because I was working at a really fancy restaurant where the chef got a James Beard Award, you know, so it felt edifying. It shows up in the work in the way that when I first moved there, I came from Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta is known as Chocolate City, mm-hmm. and like every other black person in Atlanta has a Range Rover, you know, so you can kind of live in a bubble there, you know, because I felt like when I moved here, I felt like the projects in Atlanta looked like the housing for Morgan University students. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had never seen poverty at such a level in the United States as I had like in the disparate regions that are in that city, the boarded up homes and just the food deserts and all of that. And so to me, it was like a third world country. Like that's what I looked at it as. I'm like, so I feel like you can judge a city by how its poor are living, you know? So I really started to pay attention to that in a different way. And it really depressed me. I was like really depressed for a year. I was on the bus too. So, you know, when you're on public transportation, you, in a way, get to be a voyeur because like I knew that wasn't my life, but I'm riding the 13 with everybody else. And I remember one time I was sitting next to this guy and somebody had opened the city paper and these two children had been shot in their front yard. And the man in front of us was reading the paper and he said, wow, this is really crazy, this happened. And the guy sitting next to me was like, yeah, those are my babies. Mm. And I'm like, damn, you know? So I still can't tell that story without just like clutching my pearls. So It's in your face. Like, you can choose to ignore it, but it's in your face, and it's something that I absolutely could not ignore. Mm-hmm. And so I just happen to have a lot of friends that work in public health, so I was able to engage in work that, you know, really got me into the narrative of the people that we tend not to think about the most. But my studio is in Lexington Market, which is an area that's being gentrified now. So, like, the Hippodrome is there, Everyman Theater is there, but there's also a methadone clinic there. So during the day, it's a little bit chaotic. It's, you know, the man on the corner selling the final call, he's there every day. There's, like, this guy named Swole, because he got Swole in jail. He sells water, he shows up every day, crisp white sneakers, like, starched jean shorts and a wife beater. There's this woman who dances, like, to church music. She's a mime, and she's, like, all day with, like, white makeup on her face. So there was a lot happening there, but and she was the most imaginative thing that was happening there. And so I think for me, as I would walk from my house to my studio, and at that time my favorite soundtrack, not the dorky, but was Winged Migration, the documentary about the pigeons. And so for some reason I like really liked that sound. I mean, so I was playing that, and I don't know, to hear that in my, to hear that music, but then see what was happening to me, like, felt like what, it just, I don't know, that really resonated with me. And so I really wanted to, naively, and I think in the most privileged way, because, you know, like, drop something in that space. Like, if I could drop glitter in that space or anything, like, just to break it up, because I realized that me going to my studio, using my imagination to come up with these figures, was a privilege in itself. And, like, these people don't have time to think about the work that I'm making and the work that I think that I'm making for them. You know, so I had an experience with a gentleman. So they were gonna print one of my paintings and put it on the side of a building. And the building was on Maryland and North Avenue. And the building was a public housing building. And so they wanted the tenants in the building to be a part of the discussion of what they wanted to put on, which one of my paintings they wanted to put on the side of the building. And so at that point, it was the rabbit in the hat guy. So he has on a striped kind of, what do you call it, seersucker with a baby blue bow tie. He's holding a rabbit. And when I walked into the room, these people didn't know that I was the artist. So I just kind of sat there and listened to him talk. And this older gentleman, he was offended by that image. And he said it looked like a minstrel. And he said it was, he said he, you know, basically he couldn't see himself in it. And so we end up having a conversation about, you know, how external directives influence how you think about yourself, you know, because his 14-year-old granddaughter saw what I saw when I looked at it, but she had not yet experienced what he had experienced, you know. And so he related to an image that he's like, I want to see somebody that's in a blue jumpsuit, you know, or that worked in a car, like as a car mechanic or something like that. And so just having the opportunity to, I mean, it was eye-opening for me, but just to have the opportunity to talk to him about, you know, his life and what the work could mean to him, like explain it to him in a different way was, yeah. But for a second, for 2 days, I was like, maybe I shouldn't be painting this, you know? It's like you start asking yourself all these questions, because I am painting it from my perspective, and I grew up in Georgia, my father was a doctor, and, you know, my life, you know, for all intents and purposes is like, you know, I do what I want to do, you know? Yeah. So very different.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, but, you know, still, I feel like your images are highly political in that they suggest that this is possible, that we have the ability to utilize our imaginations, and that we are able to exist outside of the norms that mm-hmm. society may put upon us. Mm-hmm. And again, it takes me back to, you know, film and TV, and, you know, I think there are some really great shows and films that are in the world right now that are sort of in line with what you're saying. But otherwise, you know, when you think of the Black presence, you know, it's like either we're this or we're that, either, you know, and they're so binary and they don't allow us to sort of imagine up what we could be. So can you sort of speak to potential in and mainly some of the accessories that you put around your subjects, like this woman, the former image with the teacup, and then I'm thinking of the equestrian with, you know, the pony. What are these sort of things that you're implementing in these images?
Yeah. Those two in particular are a little bit autobiographical. Mm-hmm. It made sense mostly in her mind, which is the girl with the unicorn was, so I took equestrian jump and hunt. I rode horses when I was like, I think for like 3 years, I went to horseback riding camp at Camp Conchardi with my best friend, Courtney Jensen. And Courtney was white, and we were set up three girls to a room in this kind of tree house. And this one little girl, the girl that was our roommate, when she walked in, she looked at us and she was like, oh. She's like, I'm so relieved I didn't have the room with a nigger. My parents were afraid that I would have to stay here the whole summer with a nigger, you know? And so I looked at Courtney and I'm just like, she's never seen a black person that looks like me. So she had no idea I was black the whole 2 months we were there. So, and I did not have a perm. So like when I went swimming, my hair was like, you know? So I made sure I gave her a hug in front of her parents. When they came to pick her up. And I saw their faces and I was like, gotcha. But I think in the beginning, I was really working through some of that in the work. And Miss Everything, Unsuppressed Deliverance, is really about that moment when you stop thinking about the fact that you're being observed. And so there's a, he's more than a writer. I guess he's like a philosopher named John Berger. Is it Berger or Berger? He wrote a book called Ways of Seeing. And he says that women in particular, which kind of made me tilt my head a little bit, that we have a camera inside of our heads. And like, so for example, if we get up and walk to the bathroom, we're watching ourselves being watched by other people and like seeing them see us. And I think I just related that to my experience as you know, growing up in private schools and being like one or two of only of two black people in the elementary school and like maybe 10 out of 400 in the high school. And how my mother explained to me when I was 6 years old how I had to act because my actions would be seen different than the other kids. So like kind of getting it, but then kind of not getting it because all of a sudden you're self-aware, but you're not sure exactly why you're
right.
self-aware.
Right.
And so for Miss Everything, she's graduated from that because I feel like if you can never fully be present in your own body, then how can you grow? You know, so if black identity is based in a reactionary place, then how do we reach towards an identity that's, like I like to say, between the flesh and the spirit, so I was like raised Christian. And so if blackness is rooted in a reactive space, it remains in the flesh, right? And if we can slowly stop seeing ourselves the way that we're being seen, then maybe there's some kind of way to graduate. I mean, I think that's my journey in particular. Like, I'm looking to come out of that to see what else I am in the world, you know? But it's also very difficult to do because, for example, when I worked in the jail, it's like it's hard because I'm having this one experience and then I have people that look like me that are having the exact opposite experience, you know? So like trying to come to terms with that inside of my own head is still like something that I think about a lot.
Can you speak to the scale of your work? And something that you pointed out to me that I thought was really brilliant is that there's a particular way that you actually install your work because you want people to have this one-to-one experience with the person. And just thinking about the way that your subjects are gazing out into the world, I think that's really powerful too, which is to suggest that they have their own experience and they have their own identity. So can you talk about some of the reactions you've seen people have when they encounter your work at this one-to-one ratio?
I've had people start crying. Which was strange at first, but you know, I hang the paintings. I like them hung anyway, about a foot lower than they would normally be hung. So I really feel like it's an impersonal experience to go to a museum and you're like looking up at something. So you're able to walk up to this person and engage them in a way, and they're engaging you in a way, because like, to be visible is to be human. And so these really express a humanity that I feel like I don't see exist in the world. And I think that's why I don't have them placed anywhere, because it's an individual experience. I want them to be infinitely present, right? Not timelessly present. And I think that the eyes are the most important part of the portrait for me, and so that's another reason why I want it hung a little lower. But I just really want the viewer to engage in the way that they want to. Yeah. I mean, my titles kind of lead you in a little bit, mm-hmm. but it's really about being able to find yourself in these images, no matter what color you are, what gender you are. Mm-hmm. It's about a universalism that I want to see exist with blackness.
And I really appreciate your titles, because I love a good title. And the worst thing is, and I know this is like part of a history, but the worst thing is like, okay, I'm looking at Untitled 1, I'm looking at Untitled 5, and now I'm at Untitled 27, and I don't know which one is which anymore. So can you sort of speak, I know you have a really interesting approach as to how you come up with your titles, and it's kind of collaborative. Can you speak on
that? Yeah, I text these images to my sister and be like, name this.
No.
My sister is a writer, and she's really good at it. She didn't make it a career, but it started with a friend of mine. Her name is Shayna, and we were paired together as an artist and a poet for a catalog for the Studio Museum, like a long time ago, like 2007. Mm-hmm. And she wrote this poem, and in the poem there was a line that mentioned or had the words well-prepared and maladjusted in it. Mm-hmm. And so I named that first painting, and it was a seminal piece for me, well prepared and maladjusted. I feel like I could put that on my tombstone. It just like represents who a lot of us are, but it's particularly who I am. And like, I'm like, I have to follow that up with something great, you know? So if I couldn't name it, because normally I buy a lot of books of poetry, and I read them every day. And if I'm reading whatever I'm reading, like sometimes words and sentences come together in ways that I recognize as something that I might potentially paint. So I have like a bowl of little sticky notes of just these words that I kind of source. And then when I can't do that, my sister Harriet comes in to help me out. And so she'll send me like 3 or 4. Lately she hasn't been on it though, so I had to name them myself, which is why one of them got named after a whole Lucille Clifton poem. You know, I'm like, I'm sending you the whole poem.
Right.
But that's usually how it works. But she's, for me, it's because I feel like I'm too close to it to really be able to name it. I feel like if I had to name it myself, it'd be like a year later, and that's not gonna work, you know?
Right.
So she's able to look at it and assess it for what it is without mm-hmm. any emotional attachment. Mm. And so I like having that partnership with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanna to speak on the Obama era in general, mm-hmm. Because, you know, even though we've just started a new era and reflecting on it, I think as a curator and just looking at sort of the general zeitgeist of art, the Obama era really made room for so many black creatives. And I'm just thinking of black contemporary art and just sort of seeing in many levels how it was given this platform that it had never had before.
I've heard that. And I'm like, I was like, I guess because I was in it, I didn't see it happen, but people have said that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think like the pinnacle for me was like seeing that image of the Alma Thomas, you know, just installed at the foot of this table in the White House, mm-hmm. and what that could mean, and how much potential there was there. So in thinking about that, can you sort of speak on what was this experience like for you, getting the call or sort of understanding that you would be painting, you know, Michelle Obama? And just a caveat to that, you know, there's been a lot of conversation around monuments and their capacity in this nation, and I see your images as monuments. because they have this potential and their scale, and they just suggest that they are part of a historical legacy, maybe a legacy that we haven't even fully grasped yet or understood. And so I kind of see you going into this making as making a monument, a historical monument. So can you speak to that?
Wait, you asked me two questions. Which one?
I know. I guess we can start with, just your experience in getting that call. And yeah, what was that for you?
It was exciting. Yeah. I was in my studio working. And honestly, I felt like I didn't almost die. I didn't like almost die, get a heart transplant to get to the White House to meet them for them not to pick me. So that's what I was thinking the whole time. But I'm pretty low key. So I was like, yes, you know? And then I just kind of, I have to pretend like it's not a big deal because I need to be able to make the painting. Yeah. And like after it's done, you will see me running through the streets naked. You know? I want to get a boomerang with her too. Like that's a dream of mine to have a boomerang with Michelle Obama on my Instagram. But I don't mean this with any hubris at all, but I feel like it made sense. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it was the first New York Times article that came out with the professor from Mount Holyoke or whatever, when he said he felt like it was I was diverging from what I normally do. I really didn't see it that way. Mm-hmm. I feel like she fully represents what I paint, which are American people. Mm-hmm. And they're Black people doing stuff, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And Black people become first ladies. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it feels natural to have her as a subject. Yeah.
Well, we're gonna open it up to Q&A and we'll have a little time for that. Right here.
Hi, can you talk a little bit about your subjects and how they respond to your work and how you carry on relationships with them after the paintings are finished?
Some of them I do carry on relationships with, some of them I don't. This kid right here, Randall, I do. He just graduated from high school, so I stay in touch with him. And you know, I imagine myself like when I really get rich and famous, like, you know, I'm gonna pay for your first year of college or, you know, doing stuff like that. Morgan, I also have stayed in touch with. She's the girl looking out, peering out underneath with the sun in her face. She was 11 when I met her, and I met her in Patterson Park where I lived because she asked to play with my dog. And when I saw her, I'm like, yeah, she's like, oh, I love her. I just want to eat her. She's so cute. And so I was just talking to her, you know, and I said, so what's your favorite subject in school? And she's like, it's math. And she's like, I like reading too, but I don't know what else they can teach me because I read at a college level. And so I'm like, really? And so I said, well, show me where your mom is, because I wanted to talk to her mom about, you know, about painting her. And I said, so Morgan says she reads at a college level? And she's like, she goes to sixth grade reading. She's in the third grade. So I'm like, oh, okay. But so when she saw the completed portrait, she was texting me, and she was like, so I saw the painting. And I'm like, yeah. I said, what did you think? And she's like, I think you did a pretty good job of capturing all of my characteristics. I think I would give you an A+. So I adore her. I don't get to spend as much time with her as I want to, but she really took to me. So like after we photographed, I just sometimes with some of my models, like especially with like families, I hate to just like come in and bounce. So I went upstairs and played video games for a little bit. And so I stayed for about an hour, and then I was like, all right, I'm gonna go. And she's like, I want to come with you. And I'm like, she can't come with me, you know? And her mom was like, yeah, it's okay, she can come with you. Yeah. And so she ended up spending the day with me. And then she started crying. She didn't want to go back home. Because I was meeting some friends at a bar. She's like, I'll just come to the bar and play on my phone. I'm like, I cannot bring you to a bar. So yeah, she's adorable.
Questions
Yeah. In the beginning, for some reason, I used to like the fact that you could see the charcoal drawing. Do you need to repeat the question?
Oh, okay. The question was about the different markings that show up in Amy's work and looking at some of the pencil areas and the process.
Yeah, the process. So I do the backgrounds first. With the speckled background, then I usually, and this makes absolutely no sense, but I start each painting with Napathol Red. And it's like something that I did, and now when I don't do it, I feel like I'm gonna have bad luck or something. So each painting starts with that coat of red, and I let it dry. And then depending on how many layers I'm gonna have on top as far as the kind of liminal space that I create, I paint that color on, I lay it flat, and I drip turpentine, and the turpentine kind of separates the paint, right, in these different areas. And I really thought that was something, I thought it was pretty random. Like, I stand there and I do like this, but I had a young lady work with me and I'm like, you know, go ahead and drip it, let me see you do it. And then when she started it, I'm like, no, that's all wrong. And I'm like, I know these are only drips, but like for some reason, I see things differently than she was seeing it. So that's layer by layer until I get to a place that I want. Like this one right here was just, it was red on red. So after that, I start the drawing of the figure in charcoal. So I let it dry for a few days and I start the drawing with charcoal because that way I can draw and redraw until I get things right because charcoal just wipes away. So in the beginning, I would leave that there because I thought it was cool. I'm not sure why. So it's like just kind of random if you see it. But as the paintings progressed, I started to wipe them away. It might have just been because I was lazy and I didn't want to repaint the background, honestly, I think. Because then I would have had to almost redo the whole thing. So it helps now that the backgrounds are flat because it makes it a lot easier. But yeah, does that answer your question? Okay.
Right here.
Yes, I have a question regarding the process. So, do you take your own photographs, or do you have somebody to take?
I take my own photographs. Yeah, the painting starts in the photograph. It starts when I'm looking through the viewfinder. I'm searching for the image, the pose, all that kind of stuff. It definitely starts there. I can't let anybody else photograph them. It's weird. Yeah. I usually don't, no. I don't like people in my studio when I'm working. So the fact that I have my laptop, it makes it great for me because I don't have to look at them. Mm-hmm. Unless I want to, but.
Right here?
It's, yes, canvas. Mm-hmm. What do I think the impact will be after being commissioned to paint Michelle Obama upon choosing other subjects? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it'll have any impact. I think I make what I make. I paint who I paint. You know, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who are going to want me to paint them that I'm not going to want to paint because they're not going to have the thing. So I'm going to hurt a lot of people's feelings. But you have to have whatever it is that I need you to have in order for me to want to paint you. So, and it's not even about the money. Like, you could offer me $1 million, and I'd still be like, no, I don't want to paint you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't think it'll have any effect on that.
What?
Does the thing change from time and space, or is it the person? What is the thing that
the model has when I see them? The best way that I can think to describe it is that they have something about their energy or spirit or something that exists in the past and the present and the future. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like what I see in their eyes when I look at them is what I'm somehow able to assert when I'm painting the portrait that makes these simple images so precious and so emotional. And they still exert a pressure for interpretation. So I think, and I mean, like, this is all magic, right? So, I mean, who knows? But, like, that's what I like to think happens because a lot of what I do is intuitive because I did change my major from pre-med to art like way later on, so I never got a lot of the training that most artists get, and so that's how I've really learned how to get through life. It's like with my intuition, and so So no, it doesn't change. Like, that's going to be a constant.
Are you thinking of using them as subjects for your paintings, or are you, obviously Michelle Obama is going to search for your work or whatever, but I mean, these people obviously probably would not have enough resources to make your worthwhile paintings.
Who are you talking about?
I mean, the people of Baltimore.
That live in the city?
Yeah.
These are Baltimore City people. Yeah.
I don't see them in the street.
You do see them in the street. You may not recognize them in the clothes that I have them in, but these are Baltimore City people. These are some of the kids that I work with YouthWorks. These are the kids that paint murals in the 21217 zip code after Freddie Gray died. Like, they're all there. Randall was one of them. Yeah. But what I'm presenting to you is a softer image. And what I'm presenting to them is a mirror for them to see themselves in, mm-hmm. right? So there's a writer, Juno Diaz, he says, that people ask him why he writes. He says to make mirrors because he said vampires don't have reflections. And so that's what I'm doing. So these are those kids. You just don't recognize them. Wait, say that again?
You have personal engagement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let someone you got feeling about them. Would you ever consider taking images, taking photos, going to a park?
Just like going to the park, taking pictures and yeah, it would be totally different. It would be a different painting. Yeah. Because he's also, you know, again, because I think about photography a lot, like I relate these images to those black and white images that I saw where, you know, they're facing you for a reason and they're looking at you for a reason and they're present in these portraits for a reason. And so that would mean less to me. Yeah, I would have less of a connection with the work, I think. In grad school? I mean, we were learning about contemporary artists, but we were learning about artists that they wanted us to know about, you know? So I feel like they're a lot better about that now. I mean, I am endowed chair at MICA now in the undergraduate department, in the painting department for that reason, because they're trying to bring in women of color so that there's different perspectives, you know? So, I mean, even with the work that I was making in grad school, Grace Hartigan was my director at the time. And I think all of my colleagues that are painters, all of my colleagues that are just artists in general that come through a graduate program, we all speak to the same experience of getting crits and people not knowing how to engage us in the work that we're doing and in the things that we're trying to say. And so, for example, with her, I would paint these figures and I would veil them in black and then I would like ball up a t-shirt and like dab them away so it kind of looked like lace. Mm-hmm. And so the next year, I'm like, okay, well, let me try it with white. So I just tried it with white. So she comes to my studio, and she says that I'm struggling between my Africana and my European. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so she thought, one, I was mixed, which I'm, you know, like, technically not. Both my parents are black, although we have stuff happening from the dirty south. So she said, you don't relate to the world as a white woman? And I was like, no. I mean, how could you even look at me and think that? You know, and so that kind of stuff is like, it's mind-blowing. But like, so yeah, so I'm not surprised that I graduated from Hofburger, one of top five painting schools in the country, and I did not know who Barclay Hendricks was, and I did not know who Carrie James Marshall was.
If you were on the number 13 bus and John Waters got on and did not recognize him, sat down next to you, would you be interested in painting him?
Not really. If John Waters got on a bus and sat down next to me, would I be interested in painting him? And I said, not really. I mean, it's what I do. It's a manifesto, right? It's a critique on art history. And as much as I love white people, I don't feel the need to paint them because, I mean, look at art history. I don't feel like, you know, y'all need to be painting us. Oh, sorry, you. I don't paint these people. I cut them off at the knees. I think because, okay, so the size of the canvas is 54 by 43 for all of these except for like this one. They're all, I think, 71 by 51, something like that. But I wanted the figure to be almost life size. But I also needed the canvas to be a certain size because I only had a certain amount of money to buy the wood, to make the stretchers, and to buy the paint. And I was also thinking about transportation, like, can this fit in the back of an SUV? You know, these are things starving artists think about. So that's technically why it worked, where their heads are the same size as your head. Everything else, you know, it's life size. Yeah, and it just worked. And also, like, cropping, you know, the way that photographs are cropped probably came into play somehow, too. But and I just wasn't really interested in painting the shoes, you know. But mostly it was because, I don't know, like, it just worked. Like, you take a photograph, like, the first few I took, I was kind of working with it and trying to figure out what I wanted, and that's just what I knew was going to work. Mm-hmm. Yay, Hebrew, yeah. I say visit graduate schools and look at the work that's coming out, like, you know, buy work from graduating artists because you never know what's gonna happen. But I say, I don't know, because I'm not a collector, but buy what you love. But again, if I was looking for work, then I would be showing up at, I guess, like Micah's Art Walk or driving to Pennsylvania Art Academy, PAFA, and checking out the artists that are coming out of the schools. And then you start to develop an eye. And you'll see, once you start looking at a lot of work, you'll kind of know what's going to rise to the top and what's not. Mm-hmm. And you can get in before it gets too expensive.
Yeah, I would just piggyback off of that, because I work with a lot of collectors, and I totally agree, you know, looking at the graduate level, you know, every major school has, you know, an end of the year or a graduating group show. And it's a really great place where not only you can see the work, but you can meet the artist. And I think something for, you know, people who are just interested in collecting because they like the work and really appreciated it, not that it's like some big name artist, is to really think about how you can support those artists and how that support extends their career and actually adds to the legacy of the work that they're making.
Okay, Hugh. It was in college. Like I said, I was pre-med and I was not doing great in school. My father had a master's degree in biology and he would tutor me. And he would just be like, I don't understand what happened to my child. So I feel like I made the decision out of fear because I ran into this guy that was selling prints on the avenue on Clark Atlanta's campus, and I was like, I'm an artist too. And he's like, oh, let me see some of your work. And so I went back and got this Prismacolor pencil drawing that I'd done in, I think I was a junior or senior in high school, and then it won like honorable mention at University of Georgia, like some kind of art competition. And I said, this is what I did. And then he said, you know, if you don't use your talent, you'll lose it. And then for some reason that I was like so shaken by that I ended up changing my major that year. But I was going into my junior year by that time. So I'd been like education major, educational psychology major, sociology major, arts education major. I was just all over the place.
We have time for about two more questions.
I feel love when I'm painting. I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Some people could relate it to going to church. I feel like I'm praying sometimes. But yeah, it just feels good. Yeah, I feel happy when I'm painting.
What are your thoughts on self-portrait?
I do want to do one of me and my dog, August Wilson. I don't know when it's gonna happen, but I would like to think soon. Yeah, I can't figure out who I wanna be, you know? I don't think I can paint myself as me, so I have to figure out how I'm gonna paint myself. Yeah. Mm-mm. Yep.
Do you wanna take one more question?
Yeah, I'll take one more.
Okay.
Okay, this is hard. Now I feel like
I'm
gonna...
Now, right?
Okay, let's see, I'm gonna go all the way to the back just because you're in the back. Huh? Okay, what? Okay, so you, and then we'll do one more from over there.
Okay.
Yeah, you. What responsibility do I think I have as an artist in these times with a lot of racial turbulence? Responsibility. I don't know. I mean, I feel responsible regardless of whether I'm an artist or not. Like, I feel that responsibility within myself. Mm-hmm. And always have carried it like the golden shackle. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I feel like they do the work that they're supposed to do. I don't think of it as a responsibility, but more as it's a pleasure to represent and offer people spaces, I mean, places or images to rest their eyes upon. Mm-hmm. In times where it's even hard for me to go on the internet and like, you know, read the news or whatever. So I want them to feel like safe places, but I don't know if I think of it as a responsibility. Like just with the art itself, but I think I feel responsible as a Black woman. That I don't know whether that makes sense or not, but yeah. Okay.
Before I want to thank you for the conversation, it's really great to hear about your work. I appreciate your candor. You were talking earlier about
They ended up not putting it up there because nobody would sign off on whether or not it would blow off the side of the building. So now it's sitting in a warehouse. I think they're still going to try to figure out what to do with it, but I'm hoping somebody just mentioned it to me that it may be going up somewhere on Pennsylvania Avenue, which would be great. It's the, I don't know, it's the girl with the quilted skirt standing on a bar with her arms up. I don't think it's in this rotation, though. It's in the U.S. Embassy in Dakar, Senegal.
Maybe we should put it on the White House.
Yeah. That would be awesome. What I really want to know is how Melania is going to copy this First Lady portrait. That's what I really want to know. What is she going to do?
So I just wanted to close it out saying thank you all for being here, and thank you, Amy, one of the masters of our time.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.